Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Greg Dalton, the Chief Operating Officer of the club and your moderator for today. We also welcome our listeners on radio and invite everyone to join us at commonwealthclub.org. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Romero took the helm of the ACLU just 4 days before the September 11th attacks. Under his leadership, the ACLU sued the federal government over the Patriot Act and filed litigation on the torture and abuse of detainees in U.S. custody. Last year, in a case brought by the ACLU against the NSA spying program, a federal court ruled unconstitutional the Bush administration's warrantless surveillance of Americans' phone calls and emails. Mr. Romero is the ACL's sixth executive director and the first Latino and openly gay man to serve in that capacity. In 2005, he was named one of Time Magazine's 25 most influential Hispanics in America. He has received dozens of public service awards and an honorary doctorate from the City University of New York School of Law. Born in New York City to parents who hailed from Puerto Rico, he was the first in his family to graduate from high school. He is a graduate of Stanford University Law School and in Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy and International Affairs. Please welcome Anthony Romero.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction. It's wonderful to see many good friends in the audience and some new friends who I know I will meet this evening. I want to thank you very much at the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to one of my favorite cities in the world, San Francisco. Now, a lot has changed since I lived in the Mission District during my last year in law school. San Francisco is known for its incredible views, and I'll never forget the view I had from my apartment, the view of the dumpster for the sushi restaurant that was just downstairs from me. And it took me a long time after that before I could eat raw fish again, or especially even smell it. And a lot has changed since then in San Francisco. They probably put a screen on the dumpster and sold it for $1.6 million and change, I would guess. And the Mission is quite a different place now than it was when I lived there in the late 1980s. But a lot has also stayed the same. The Bay Area is an energetic, diverse, progressive community that boasts bustling ethnic and alternative neighborhoods, and probably the highest percentage of both would-be hippies and would-be dot-com billionaires of any city in the world. Nothing against the rest of this country, but when I hear conservative commentators talk about the real America, I want them to come to San Francisco and see how great the real America can be. America is at its best when we are confident and optimistic. And I think that those two traits are ones that describe and characterize the residents of the Bay Area. And no wonder, this is a state where someone who can barely speaks English and has hardly a friend could arrive with nothing but a pair of biceps and grow up to be governor and marry a Kennedy. And in fact, I think a good deal of the problems we have today stem from lack of confidence. When decisions are based on fear and insecurity, they are bad decisions. And for the last 6 years, our elected officials have been making decisions based on fear. This is what I find ironic. The missionaries of American exceptionalism, people whose blinders allow them to see only what they consider best about the United States and to ignore the harsher realities of the nation, they always seem to be afraid of gays, of Mexicans, of Arabs, of change, of ideas. Whereas the people I work with, who are paid to spend our nights and days wrestling with some of the darkest parts of our nation, are profoundly optimistic. Having spent the last 6 years traveling America as executive director of the ACLU, and the last 2 years researching my new book, In Defense of Our America, I am now more optimistic than ever. I'm still scared about what the Bush administration may do next, but I'm confident nonetheless. Confident because for all the change in our nation and our world, I think there is still a fundamental optimism here and a respect for the values and liberties that make America unique. If you listen to the president, you'll hear that everything changed on September 11th. And now, certainly, I'm personally in favor of change. I'm a gay Puerto Rican man. If America hadn't changed dramatically in the last generation, there's a good chance I'd be a waiter like my father or work in a factory like my grandmother instead of speaking before you here today. But when President Bush makes things different, he shows a particular genius for making them worse. He correctly points out that the war on terror is a different kind of war. And because of that, he claims the right to be a different kind of president. And he certainly is different, though not in the way he often means. In his world, being a different kind of president means making America a different kind of nation. The question for us as Americans is, do we want to be a different kind of America? Once a sanctuary for refugees and political prisoners, President Bush would have America now hold prisoners indefinitely without habeas corpus, win confessions through torture, and try prisoners in kangaroo courts called military commissions. Once a model of democracy, President Bush would have the president rule without check, ignoring laws passed by Congress, denying or even taking away the jurisdiction of our judges, and concealing every action from the public eye. Once a model of tolerance and a vast laboratory for the free exchange of ideas, President Bush would now have us bar scholars from foreign countries, close off the free press from the governing process, and spy on those who dare to disagree with the government. Now, the president and his supporters don't have enough confidence in the strength and the innate decency of the American people and the power of the ideas upon which this great nation was founded to trust us to win the war on terror in our way. Their doubts about democracy are as great as the fear of terror itself, and so the decisions they make are just simply wrong. The battle against the jihad truly is a war for hearts and minds. And we're losing it, my friends. There are 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, including 10 million of them in the United States. We're losing the battle of ideas. According to current surveys, Muslims overwhelmingly reject Al-Qaeda and attacks on civilian targets. But today, almost three-quarters of the people in Pakistan and Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim nations, believe that the U.S. is committed to weakening and dividing Islam. And a strong majority of Muslims in Europe now also have an unfavorable view of the United States. Last week was the 20th anniversary of a speech by another optimistic Californian, one I don't often cite. But do you remember Mr. Gorbachev tear down that wall? And one thing about Ronald Reagan that I will say, even when he was rallying America against an adversary with 1.5 million troops aimed at the West German border and 20,000 tanks ready to roll, he always conveyed the sense that we would prevail. And along with a string of post-war presidents, he was able to face down an implacable foe while largely preserving the basic civil liberties that this president, our president, now views as obstacles to winning the war on terror. Rather than harming people at home and angering people abroad, we won the Cold War and brought people together. By contrast, when President Bush questions the strength of our people and of our government, of our system of checks and balances, he is animated not by optimism, but by cynicism. What else could you call his efforts to infect an American people and an American government with that fear. And it worked for a while, my friends. There have been some dark nights over the last 6 years. There have been times, just like when you're sick or you're caring for a loved one who is ill, just when your head tells you that dawn is yet to come, yet your heart begins to doubt, that those are moments that we also experience as the American people. But lately, there has been new light on the horizon, some of it shining from the most unexpected of sources. And for having been so long in coming, every ray of light seems twice as bright. The Bush administration's parallel system of justice, that un-American mixture of stolen and aggrandized executive power, of torture and illegal wiretaps, of suppressed votes and unbridled partisanship, is finally being dismantled brick by brick by a coalition of conscience committed to the Constitution and to the rule of law. Here are some examples of progress that I would point to you today. Last month, in two separate military courts, judges threw roadblocks in front of the administration attempts to establish a heads I win, tails you lose military commission system for prisoners detained at Guantanamo Bay. Just last week, we saw the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that the executive branch cannot arbitrarily and indefinitely confine a U.S. legal permanent resident to prison, even one subjected to plotting heinous crimes. The U.S. Circuit Court judge, Diana Gribben Motz, wrote, quote, "The president cannot eliminate constitutional protections with the stroke of a pen by proclaiming a civilian, even a criminal civilian, as an enemy combatant subject to indefinite military detention." And though it appears that it may take the new majority in Congress, it may take them longer to lead us to the promised land than it took Moses, we are at least no longer going backwards. Earlier this month, the Senate Judiciary Committee approved legislation that would bring habeas corpus back to Guantanamo Bay or anywhere else where the captives are confined. We read recently of Bob Barr, a deeply conservative former member of Congress and a friend of the ACLU, who is now calling for an end to discrimination against gays and lesbians in the military. But perhaps most refreshingly was hearing a major architect of the war in Iraq speak eloquently and persuasively about the rule of law and America's role in the world. On Meet the Press last week, former Secretary of State Colin Powell said, quote, "If it were up to me, I would close Guantanamo not tomorrow, but this afternoon. And I would not let any of those people go. I would simply move them to the United States and put them into our federal legal system. Every morning I pick up a paper and some authoritarian figure, some person somewhere, is using Guantanamo to hide their own misdeeds. And so essentially we have shaken the belief that the world had in America's justice system by keeping a place like Guantanamo open and creating things like the military commission." Now, former Secretary of State Colin Powell nailed it perfectly. We lead the world and we win wars by holding tight to our principles and by proving that we are a nation of laws and justice. We do it by making decisions rooted in our confidence in the values that make our nation great. And in that spirit, our next priority at the ACLU is to bring habeas corpus back to the American justice system. Habeas corpus is arguably the most fundamental right of American citizenship, of citizenship of any free nation. It simply means that the government cannot lock you up for no reason and keep you as long as it wants. But now the Bush administration holds that they have all they need to designate you as an enemy combatant, with no public evidence or judge's finding of probable cause. And they can treat you roughly the same way that Stalin treated the dissident Solzhenitsyn: unlimited detention, isolation from families, attorneys, and from human rights organizations, and confessions won through physical abuse or convictions based on hearsay and rumor. When the habeas corpus rights were stripped from the detainees in Guantanamo through the Military Commissions Act, we realized that this, in fact, was a quite dark moment for the American democracy. So we launched and are mounting a day of action on June 26 in Washington, D.C., to save habeas corpus and to rewrite the Military Commissions Act to reflect our nation's basic values and to make it a more valuable tool in the war on terror. Thus far, we have more than 2,200 individuals who've registered for this day of action in Washington from every state across the country, including individuals from our Northern California affiliate who've organized a delegation to Washington. Speaking of our Northern California affiliate with Maya Harris and my colleagues in the room, which I hope you all are supporting generously, and if you are not doing so already, I will encourage you to do so at the end of the event. They have joined the national office in a very important lawsuit that we recently filed that we believe protects civil liberties by making it clear that private companies cannot profit from illegal acts. In this lawsuit, Mohammed et al. Versus Jeppesen Data Plan, we are taking an important first step forward in our battle against the practice of extraordinary rendition. When we kidnap and pick people off of the streets of foreign countries and transport them to other countries where we know they will be tortured, this practice has been given the dubious label of extraordinary rendition. Knowingly profiting from torture is immoral and illegal, and private companies are not above the law. Corporations that choose, and choose knowingly, to support torture in the face of international law and common decency can and should be held accountable. Without participation of corporations like Jeppesen, the CIA's rendition program would never have gotten off the ground, and three men who are our clients in that lawsuit might now be free and might be whole. ACLU litigators, politicians, and public figures, courts all around the country, all of these are coalescing into a broad movement to take America back to its proper place. The strength of America, however, does not lie in its elites. It lies with the American people and their ability to respond to extraordinary pressures in extraordinary ways, to quietly and confidently accept the responsibilities of our age. And for all the praise I've lavished on the Bay Area, these are qualities you find in quantity, not just in California, but in every state across the nation. As I mentioned earlier, I spent the last 2 years working on this book with my co-author, Dina Temple Raston from NPR. It's called In Defense of Our America. It tells the stories of courageous people fighting bigotry, religious extremism, and a repressive government that tries to undercut the basic values of our democracy. We take as self-evident that the guarantees in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution are not just paper guarantees that some long-dead founding father wrote on parchment, that those are guarantees that we must live up to every day in our life, for every person in America. The book took me to Kansas, where I met one of our clients, the developmentally disabled 18-year-old Matthew Limon, who engaged in a consensual sexual experience with a boy 3 years his junior. And because he was 18 and the boy was just shy of his 15th birthday, Matthew Limon received a 17-year sentence for the sexual act he committed with that other younger boy. Had he been a straight teenager with a younger girl, the maximum sentence that Matthew Limon would have suffered or been given would have been 15 months. The fact that he was sentenced to 17 years for us raised significant questions about equal protection of the laws. The Kansas Attorney General, Phil Klein, wrote in a brief saying that treating Matthew like a straight kid would, quote, begin a toppling of the dominoes that would end in three-party marriages, incestuous marriages, and child brides, he wrote. But thanks to Matthew's courage and his persistence and the hard work of activists and the Kansas ACLU and the Lesbian and Gay Rights Project of the ACLU, we won. We were able to release Matthew after him serving 5 years in prison. The Kansas courts unanimously ruled that the grossly disparate sentences violated the Equal Protection Clause. They rejected fear for common sense, and Matthew was set free to go back to his family. The book took me also to the University of California, Santa Cruz, not far from here, where I met a great patriot, a young man called Kot Hordynski, the son of two Polish immigrants who fled communism seeking freedom in America. Kot envisions and embodies the American dream. He went to college. He engaged his classmates in a longer discussion of what America should be like. He took issue with the military recruitment on college campuses, and he and his fellow classmates organized pamphlets and tables and information and protests against military recruitment at UC Santa Cruz. And then 1 year later, on Christmas break, Kot Hordynski turns on his email, only to find that he has been labeled a credible threat against the nation and entered into the Department of Defense Talon database and has been the subject of Pentagon surveillance. Now imagine the greatest military on earth and afraid of college kids like Kot Hordynski. But Kot and his friends persisted. They believed in America, and they did what was right. They refused to back down, and they turned to the ACLU for help. The book took me to Dover, Pennsylvania, where I met a remarkable woman, Bert Spahr. It reminds you of all the science teachers you hated while you were in high school and loved when you graduated. A woman with a practical haircut and comfortable shoes, the size of a large collie. And when the Discovery Institute tried to find a jurisdiction where they wished to insert religion into the public school science classrooms, one thing they didn't count on was that Bert Spahr would stand up to them. She and her fellow science teachers fought to keep fundamentalist religion in the guise of intelligent design out of their classrooms. And with the support of the Pennsylvania ACLU, they won a significant victory for those of us who are eager to keep a bright line between the separation of church and state. This Republican-appointed judge in that federal case wrote, quote, "The students, parents, and teachers of the Dover Area School District deserve better than to be dragged into the legal maelstrom with its resulting utter waste of money and personal resources," he wrote. As I told Bert Spahr, people like me have the easy job. The hard part is finding people like Bert Spahr who have the courage to stand up. But everywhere I go, find them indeed we do. People like Matthew, like Kot, like Bert, who have the courage to fight for our America. And sometimes in the strangest of places, you find this patriotism and this understanding of core American values. I met a trucker at the sports bar in Great Bend, Kansas, who thanked me for fighting for America on a different front. The young soldier with whom I went swimming in the waters of Guantanamo Bay told me, "I believe in our president, but I'm really glad you're here, Anthony. You have a job to do." True patriots are everywhere, and they are not afraid. In small towns and big cities all across America, even in Guantanamo Bay, there is a new and growing majority who share a quiet confidence in the American system. They and we were all scared for a while, and some bad decisions got made. But I believe, my friends, that we're getting our footing back. We're remembering who we are as Americans. And in a world where so much has changed in the last 20 years, one thing has stayed the same. One thing that fills me with confidence and pride, that the American people truly understand what makes this nation great. That in a country with no unifying language, no unifying culture, no unifying religion, the one thing that does bind us as Americans is our commitment to the rule of law and to some basic values inscribed in some fundamental founding documents. That when we salute the flag and sing the Star-Spangled Banner, when we go to the Ground Zero site and feel patriotic, that those emotions that course through our bodies have to do about American values that have defined us for centuries. That there are values like innocent until proven guilty, the right to an attorney, the right to rebut evidence against you in a court of law, the right to due process, the right to equal protection of the laws. Those are what make this country great. And I am confident that no matter what the challenges and no matter what the ideologues in this or the next administration, with the help of good Americans like you and the true patriots like Cott and Burt and others, that we will make sure that America stays true to its great principles. I look forward to your questions and to your discussion with you. Thank you very, very much.
Our thanks to Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union and author of An In Defense of Our America. I'm Greg Dalton, and I'll moderate our question and answer period here at the Commonwealth Club. Does or should the ACLU provide the public policymakers with your proposals for fighting terrorism? There's a couple questions here about that. What are the alternatives? What trade-offs would you be willing to make in terms of civil liberties in a time of war? What are your alternatives?
Yeah. Well, I think taking the first part of that question first, it's a very good question. And in fact, it's one that we've worked very hard at the ACLU, is to make sure that we're not just oppositional to all of the proposals and policies that come down the pike or that are suggested by policymakers. I think we do have an essential role to suggest ideas and ways that we can ensure the safety and the freedom of the American people. I think if we were only oppositional and throwing stones at any of the glass houses in Washington and not proffering good ideas and alternatives, we would not be serving our full job. We have something on our website. We have a document on our website that's on our safe and free section of the website where we discuss security measures that we believe would help assure our security without compromising our civil liberties. There are things, for instance, that we didn't take issue with in the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act was enacted 45 days after the 9/11 attacks. It's a 345-page document. Much of what's in the law we never took issue with. They were good changes to the laws. They were necessary changes to the laws. Who can argue, for instance, when the government and the INS sent Mohammed Atta an immigration visa 2 months after he took the planes into the World Trade Center? Who can argue with the need for greater information sharing across the federal agencies? There was an absolutely fundamental breakdown that needed to be addressed. Our concern is with the how, not with the if. Now, we need to fight the war on terror, but how we do it is an essential part of it. And much of what we've argued in the last 5 and almost 6 years has been the need to keep both safety and freedom primary in people's minds. That one is not the maidservant or the handservant of the other. That if you had safety without freedom, you would have a dictatorship or totalitarian regime. And if you had freedom without safety, you would have anarchy. That much of what defines America is having both on co-equal terms. And when you think about the ways in which the policies and rules of the Bush administration have undercut our civil liberties for a semblance of national security, when in fact you have the Bush administration summarily arrest and deport thousands of immigrants who had no connection to the 9/11 attacks, who are individuals who were here for minor immigration violations that would never have subjected them to jail time or to deportation, being summarily deported, that does not increase our safety, and it certainly undercuts a nation that's committed to freedom and to equality. When you allow, for instance, in one part of the Patriot Act that we take strong issue with, when you allow the government to execute national security letters, which are basically known, they're a form of administrative subpoenas, they're administrative warrants, with no judge ever signing off on that warrant, that the government can access your internet records, your financial records, your employment records, your health records, your library records, and that the government has done so in more than 149,000 cases since the 2001 attacks. When you have no judge looking over the shoulder of the executive branch, when you upset that system of checks and balances, that kind of that basic Hamiltonian, Madisonian genius, that the reason why you have three branches of government is to make sure that no one branch of government becomes abusive. And when you completely carve out the judicial branch from those self-executing warrants, We take issue with that because we don't think that's the proper way of fighting the war on terror. I think the question for us longer term is, how do we adapt to an age where we'll never be able to assure ourselves that there won't be another terrorist attack? I think our elected officials have failed the American people by not preparing us for the inevitability of another attack. The fact that we and the American people, if another attack happens, would feel that they need to do more to sacrifice their civil liberties has really meant that they have shrugged their responsibilities. But we need to remind the American people, as even as we fight the war on terror, even as we make sure that we do our best to protect the American people, that it follows some basic rules of the road, and that democracy, even though it might fight with one hand tied behind its back, that democracy always has the upper hand. And that's a fundamental belief in the long-term greatness of our founding principles and some of the founding institutions.
You mentioned that public officials have failed us. Do you think that some of the security measures that are in place now have prevented another terrorist attack?
It's hard to prove the negative. It's certainly true that I think the government and some good members of the government have done their best to assure the safety and the security of the American people. And certainly there have been improvements in some of these efforts. There's greater resources now for the translation of intelligence reports from foreign languages. There's greater information sharing across the federal agencies. There's a greater concern for the recruitment of individuals who have language skills in the FBI and elsewhere. What I worry about is the unknown and the efforts that have been kept secret from the American people that have been done to fight the war on terror. When you consider the fact that in the aftermath of 9/11, you had President Bush going to Congress with his Attorney General, then John Ashcroft, saying to members of Congress that we needed a new act, a new law, the Patriot Act, to give them increased law enforcement powers, to lower the standards for intelligence efforts based on potential terrorist threats or foreign agents, to break down this wall between criminal investigations and intelligence investigations. We had an anemic public debate, but Congress enacted that law. And yet precisely at that same time, when the men and women of Congress were enacting the Patriot Act, the president was saying to the men and women of Congress, boys and girls, go play with your marbles in the corner. Go debate the niceties of the Patriot Act. Go debate the standards that have to be set. And in secret, I will authorize wiretapping on Americans without congressional authority or approval or discussion or debate, without any judicial review. And he asserts himself as the supreme leader of our three branches of government and completely denigrated the role of Congress to one where he did the end run on what their role and the role of the judiciary. And the idea that we did not find out about that for years later, until the two brave reporters of the New York Times threatened to publish their findings of that research, and then the New York Times finally ran the story on the front page, only after they were threatened with it being out despite their efforts. And that the American people had no knowledge that the president felt himself to be above the law. And he felt that there were a group of people in America who were beneath the law's regards. There was no more fundamental constitutional challenge to the working of our system of checks and balances. And so that's why I worry most, not about what hasn't happened, but what we don't know, and the secrets that have been kept from us in the name of national security.
A number of questions ask about the organization. How do you decide which cases you take on? What are your priorities? And could you tell us a little bit about sort of the organization and how it does what it does?
That's a more complicated question. I have more direct answers for the Bush administration. The ACLU is a multi-headed hydra. We have 1,000 members of the ACLU staff who are full-time employees nationwide. About 400 of them are part of the New York and the Washington, D.C. offices. The bulk of our staff are in state offices all across this country, 600 staff members in every state across the country. The cases often come to us because people pick up the phone and they call their local ACLU because they need help. Bert Spahr from Dover, Pennsylvania, called the Western Pennsylvania office of the ACLU. Matt Limon went to the Kansas ACLU. It is often many of these cases walk in through our door and where individuals ask us for help for standing up for dignity, which is what the struggle for civil liberties is all about. Sometimes the cases are cases where we actively go out and try to find clients to help us raise the important constitutional issues of our time. So the NSA wiretapping case, where we now are waiting for a decision in the Sixth Circuit, it's a case that we consciously put together, much like Thurgood Marshall did with Brown versus Board of Education. You think through the theories of the case. You find the plaintiffs that can best raise those issues. You think about where you can best file those lawsuits. We filed that lawsuit in the Sixth Circuit because the last Supreme Court case that came from on illegal wiretapping came out of the Sixth Circuit. We have clients who are Muslim and Arab activists, but we also have clients who are researchers and experts. We have Barney Rubin, who is the foremost expert in the Taliban out of New York University, the Center for International Cooperation. We have Christopher Hitchens, who's a journalist many of you may know, not often agreeing with the ACLU, but who covers much of the war in Iraq. We have Larry Diamond from the Hoover Institute at my alma mater, Stanford, an institution that's not always known for its love of civil liberties or civil rights. We believe it was important to put together a class of plaintiffs that would show the diversity of concern for the illegal wiretapping in America. The priorities for the ACLU right now, just to be very quick, the erosion of basic civil liberties in the aftermath of the war on terror is our top organizational priority. It is an issue that we did not select, but that the president and his cronies selected for us, and we had to rise to meet that challenge. Secondly, the questions around the persistence of inequality based on race and ethnicity in America, that by all stretch of the imagination, that we're still not a country that's as free or an equal playing field as we need to be. And then third, and then most important, as importantly, is the questions around securing religious liberty and religious pluralism in a country as diverse as this, that the government should not be in the business of propagating religious beliefs and religious faiths. You add to that, obviously, the concern for the equality of gay and lesbian people and the marriage struggle that we're involved with, the right to choice, which is very much under assault. When this last Supreme Court rendered the first decision since Roe versus Wade that upheld a federal ban on abortion. And so you see an assault on all these basic rights below the radar screen often and not having to do with the war on terror. And that's why the climate for civil liberties for us is one of the most important things that we have to address and to kickstart a conversation, a discussion, like with you at the Commonwealth Club, about what America is and what we believe in.
Just a side note, both Christopher Hitchens and Larry Diamond have both been here with us recently. Hitchens was drinking a liquid that he said looked like water, but may have been water.
He has a right to do that as well.
It's his civil right to do that. Number of questions on immigration, and what is your viewpoint on the current immigration bill? Why is it that so much attention is given to Latino immigration rather than people from other parts of the world? Yeah.
The immigration bill, I've been doing a lot since the book came out in May 23rd. I've been doing a round of radio talk shows and television interviews, most often with Fox News. They seem to want me much more than the NPR affiliates. And I gladly go. It's much more interesting than some of the NPR affiliates. I love NPR, no offense. And always the issue that comes up is immigration. And it's one that has really stirred the temper and the energy of the American people, and something we haven't seen like this in quite a while. And I think the most important thing to start off with is to say, what do we do with 12 to 13 million people who are here? They're here. Like it or not, agree with it or not, they're here. What do you do with them? The suggestion that you put them all back on buses and ship them off to Mexico or Latin America or China or elsewhere is just not tenable. So what is the solution? And while Congress, fearful of venturing into a very difficult issue in the middle of an upcoming presidential election year, has done what Congress often does best. It ducks the issue. It sticks its head in the sand. And we need some very forthright talk and some very forthright answers to the American people. They're here. 12 to 13 million people are here. Do you provide them a path that allows them to show their commitment to being Americans, to pay their past debts to the society that they were a part of, to demonstrate that they want to be full incorporated members of our society, or do you further drive them underground, allowing them to be further exploited, not allowing them to further connect with the country that you want to acculturate them into? And the question for us at the ACLU is not one, we don't get into the debate of how many immigrants or what are the visas or what should the legalization program look like. That is for other groups to debate. For us is that when you provide people greater access to their rights, that America benefits. And that there were certain rights that the founding fathers reserved for citizens, the right to vote, the right to be a U.S. president is for a U.S.-born U.S. citizen, one that Mr. Governor Schwarzenegger may be trying to change. But there are other rights, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the First Amendment, where they say no person shall be denied life, liberty, or property without due process of law. It didn't say no citizen. And so the concern for us at this point is making sure that in this debate, that the quid pro quo that often gets exacted for whatever large numbers of immigrants that they will allow to become a part of the American society, that the quid pro quo not be the sacrificing of basic rights which are enshrined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. We worry also about an employer verification program, because we worry about an employer verification program that can back us into a national identity card system for all Americans. And if we're going to have that type of national identity card system, we ought to have the full and robust and vigorous debate about what it means for all Americans to have a national identity card. And we worry that, much like what we saw with the mission creep of Social Security numbers, that you'll find a mission creep around these employer verification programs. Our focus is very much targeted on this due process civil liberties issues in the immigration debate. And granting people rights in America is a good thing, not a bad thing.
You mentioned the national ID card. There's a couple of questions about that. Perhaps you could elaborate into the mission creep you mentioned. What would be so bad about a national ID card? And there's questions here about alternative forms, technological forms of identification, what you would feel about those, DNA, et cetera.
Well, I think if we're going to have that system in place, we need to have a full and robust debate. And much of what has happened over the last several years, even going back decades now to the growth of the use of Social Security numbers, that we never have that explicit debate. In fact, when you go back and look at the history on the Social Security Administration, the Social Security numbers, there was a great concern that the Social Security numbers would become your identity number in America. And there was an explicit congressional debate saying it would only be used specifically for the administration of Social Security benefits. And now we all know how essential our Social Security number is to everything we do, your credit reports, your driver's licenses, your registering to vote, any opening of bank accounts. It took on a form and a role that Congress insisted we would never take up. So we worry, having remembered and having been a part of that debate, we worry that by backing into a national identity card system, the likes of which we haven't really fully discussed or understood, that we might become a very different type of America. Do we really want to be in a country where you walk down the street and a police officer can lawfully ask you, show me your papers? And who is that police officer likely to target for such requests? They're not likely to be people who look like me and dress like me. They're likely to be people who look foreign or are minorities or are young people. And do we want to allow that tool for police harassment of the populace? Will that help build confidence between the community and the police itself? And we worry about a national identity card system, as we've seen, growing in breadth and in information that they can attach to it. That with so much of what the government is now able to do with these computer technologies, that it would not be far-fetched to link onto your national identity card further information about how you voted, previous crimes, even if you've done your time or were acquitted of your crimes, questions around your finances, your IRS returns. It's this amalgam of information that could very much begin to consolidate and provide total big brother culture in a way that we haven't yet fully debated and discussed. And so we're very much concerned by it. We think that it needs a much more robust debate. And ultimately, if Congress and the American people, having weighed the benefits and the potential pitfalls of a national identity card system, if we enact that as a law, then at least that was a good process.
Our guest today at the Commonwealth Club of California is Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Your talk about mission creep around Social Security numbers brings up the data mining industry, which every time you swipe that card at the supermarket, all that data goes into a central place that says what kind of cat food you have, and they know what kind of mortgage you have, et cetera. Are there any cases that you've taken on in that area about how much private information corporations collect on consumers?
What our concern has been, when private corporations pick up that information on consumers and either violate their own consumer privacy guidelines and their privacy policies, or when they provide it to the government. You see that latter case now here in San Francisco, where there's a number of efforts, including one by the ACLU and one by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, arguing that AT&T wrongfully turned over its information on phone calls and emails of clients to the NSA program. And so we worry about the government being able to gain much greater information on Americans by having the private sector in collusion with it in violation of our basic civil liberties. That's also the very same, it's a different ilk, but it's along the same track around our lawsuit against the Jeppesen Data Plan Company. That private companies need to take as seriously the concern and the protection for civil liberties as government, and that when they work with government, they ought not sacrifice our basic privacy rights in ways that that consumers and shareholders would not want, and we have to hold them accountable. I will just say this, that the difference, though, between the private sector doing it and the government doing it cannot be overstated. No matter what your credit bureau may collect on you, your credit bureau will never have the ability to take your property, detain you in a jail, make your life difficult with law enforcement efforts. That's a power that only government possesses. So when that private information is in the hands of the government, it is all the more problematic, because only the government can throw you in jail, can seize your assets, can arrest and detain you. That those are what the primary concerns of the ACLU is, that the invasion of privacy and the use of that information as proxies for suspicion leads down a very dark and dangerous path. That if you flew to Pakistan or you buy a Quran on the website, or if you give contributions to lawful charities, that the government then uses as proxies for whom they should be targeting or surveilling, that worries us enormously.
Your comment about the concerns about government posing a bigger threat than corporations is interesting with respect to the ACLU, often thought of as a liberal organization, and yet liberals often are thought of as being more favorable towards government and conservatives being more wanting to limit the size of government. I mean, maybe you can comment on that in terms of where you fit in the philosophical spectrum and who supports you.
We fit everywhere in the philosophical spectrum. In fact, I think one of the great misconceptions of the ACLU is that we are a liberal or left organization. I know I shouldn't say that in San Francisco, but it's true. We're a conservative organization because our goal is to conserve core American values. Often our cases that are best known are the ones that are pushing the envelope for the expansion of rights, the rights of gay and lesbian people to marry and equality in America. That's something we fundamentally believe in. Unfortunately, that's an issue that has been largely ignored by the right of center, by the Republican Party, and that's very much of our philosophy. Our concern also for the right for women to choose when and if to have a child. That's an essential part of the right of the individual to autonomy, to make his or her own decisions, that a government and a politician should not insert themselves in such decisions. That, unfortunately, is also less the province of the Republican Party. But when you look across the many issues that we work on and the many clients we have over the years, you see that we've taken on some very important issues that underscore the fact that this is not about partisan politics. That if the ACLU is relegated to being the liberties wing, the civil liberties wing of the Democratic Party, will be ineffectual. And that it's really about the rights of all people, whether you're a member of the NAACP or whether you're a member of the Nazi Party. Right now we have a case, which I know is rather controversial among many of my gay and lesbian friends, where the ACLU defends the rights of Fred Phelps, the minister who's been organizing funerals, protests at military funerals, saying that the reason why the soldiers are dying is because we are granting greater rights to gay and lesbian people. I hate what Fred Phelps stands for. He hates what I am. I don't believe in what his hateful ideology is all about. But when the government tries to enact statutes and rules that would prohibit him from being able to organize a peaceful protest on public grounds, even at such a distasteful place and at such a solemn place as a military funeral, we believe in the right to free speech. And we apply that right to free speech across the board. Our clients, some of them are a lot of fun to talk about. We can, if there are further questions, Rush Limbaugh is one of our clients. Oliver North was one of our clients. Jerry Falwell, before he died, was one of our clients. I thought perhaps our defending him in his case in Virginia may have added to his early demise. And we follow the issues where they need us, and we apply these rules neutrally, that rules and principles need to be applied to each person, and they need to be applied neutrally, and that applies for all of us.
Okay, I'll bite on that one. How is Rush your client?
Well, Rush Limbaugh, I love telling this story. I was hoping you would bite. When Mr. Limbaugh apparently got his knickers in a twist with a drug problem, and when the prosecutors came after his medical records, we filed a brief on his case saying that, in fact, the prosecutors do not have the right to confiscate the records of a private citizen with his physician. He was more than happy to have us jump in because it gave credibility to his case. What I love further as a coda to the Rush Limbaugh case is that the month after Rush Limbaugh and we took on his case, John Ashcroft issued a series of subpoenas to hospitals in Chicago and New York because they were trying to arm themselves for this most recent law school Supreme Court case on the federal ban on abortion, the so-called partial birth abortion bans. And so Mr. Ashcroft served subpoenas on the hospital saying how many women and which women were getting late-term abortions. And I called Mr. Limbaugh and I said, Mr. Limbaugh, it's Anthony Romero. Isn't it an interesting issue that's very much akin to the issue of your medical privacy? And why don't I hear it on your radio show where you can make that connection for your listeners? He begrudgingly talked about it on his last minute of the radio show, but all progress is incremental.
Several questions here about the no-fly list. How could it be more effective, and how much of a threat is that to personal liberty?
Well, it is a substantial threat to personal liberty, especially if you happen to be one of the individuals on the no-fly list, and where there isn't an opportunity to contest your name on that list, where it's a black box of government decision-making, where it begins to affect individuals and their willingness to travel and their willingness to engage the broader public. The no-fly lists are compiled secretively by the government. We don't really know what criteria or how they compile such lists. There are many lists that are being used by the government, so-called terrorism watch lists that have proliferated in the aftermath of 9/11. And what's often hard is understanding how to contest your name on that list if it's a case of mistaken identity, how individuals are meant to discern between someone whose name may be the same or similar on that list. And we worry about the question of this war on terror and the concern for suspected terrorists becoming the new McCarthyite period, where then we collected lists of suspected communists and people were banned from jobs and from gainful employment or made pariahs in their own communities, and this accretion of list collecting on individuals who did nothing wrong other than perhaps disagree with the government. And many of our clients on the no-fly litigation are, in fact, activists who all of a sudden find themselves on these no-fly lists. And one has to question whether or not that is coincidence or whether or not that's an explicit part of some effort to tamp down dissent and debate in America.
Our guest today at the Commonwealth Club of California is Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. Number of questions here about complacency and the state of public debate about civil liberties. Are there good ways for individuals to help regain civil liberties? What do you think it will take to get more people worried and involved about getting action on these issues?
I think it's a great question. That is the toughest and the most essential question that I get. Involvement of the American people is what is essential to making sure that we end up with the right answers to these questions. That much of what I've been most worried about in the early days of the aftermath of 9/11 was, in fact, when you didn't have robust public debate. When we would go to good members of Congress on both parties and say, let's have a fuller debate about these provisions of the Patriot Act. Let's talk about the erosion of the system of checks and balances. And they would say back to us, Anthony, this is not a time where we can ask the tough questions. We need to unify as a country and get behind our president. That, for me, was one of the most troubling moments in our democracy. That democracy is stronger with robust debate, with a muscular give and take of the basic issues, that we're not weaker by it, we're stronger from it. And the difficulty has been that often the members of the media and our elected officials and the members of the public were not demanding that level of scrutiny or debate. That has been building over the last 5 or so years. That's why I talked optimistically in this talk tonight. You find much greater scrutiny by members of the media, the public asking the tougher questions. Even within the Republican Party itself, you have individuals raising these very important concerns. The most important thing that we can do as Americans is holding our government's officials' feet to the fire. That we're in the middle of a presidential election, and whether you're supporting John McCain or Rudy Giuliani or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, that we need to ask them some very simple, basic questions. Will you close Guantanamo? Will you restore habeas? Would you conduct wiretapping without the approval of Congress and without the approval of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, under any circumstances? We need to ask very simple yes or no questions to get them on the record and don't let them hem or haw or get themselves off the hook. And part of what we have to do is make sure that they hear that these are the questions that will help make decisions over who we elect for whatever whatever office people hold. Ultimately, I think it's also one where we need to have our elected officials know that we're watching them. And that's why the day of action that we're having on June 26th in Washington, D.C., it's a plug, in case you didn't guess, that we need as many people there as possible to really go in front of their members of the House and Senate and ask the tough questions. Because if they think we're silent, if they think they can cudgel us into being a quiescent public, then we're not going to have the democracy we wish.
Couple of questions here regarding the Bush administration. Which policy enacted by the Bush administration is likely to have the longest and most dangerous shelf life? One question here about whether it's the worst civil rights violator. And I would add another one, which is, what have they done right on civil rights? What can you point to, if anything, that you think that they've...
That's the hardest question I've ever had. I'll have to think about that one and get back to you. You know, I think perhaps the greatest concern is this vision of an aggrandized executive branch, what they call the unitary executive, the idea that the executive is above the shoulders of the other branches of government, that the president needs souped-up powers to deal with the challenges he confronts, that the scrutiny of the government and of the courts and of Congress is bad for national security. That perhaps is, for me, the most troubling element of the emergence of the Bush legacy on civil liberties. And it's this assertion. It's done by, in fact, he's a Bay Area resident, John Yoo, a Berkeley law professor. His book, A War by Any Other Means, I suggest you read it. We need to understand how they argue these positions. And Mr. Yoo, in a very compelling way, does more than just snivel some apologist statement for the Bush administration. He provides a very different view of what is the role of the executive branch in a democracy. And that role of the executive branch and democracy is fundamentally at loggerheads with what I believe is the history of our nation and what is our commitment to three co-equal branches of government. That, for me, is the most troubling. The best thing they've done, they pushed John Ashcroft so far that even lying in a hospital bed on drugs, John Ashcroft resisted the efforts by Andrew Card and Alberto Gonzalez to approve the NSA wiretapping program. Now, John Ashcroft is no friend of mine, no buddy of civil liberties, but the idea that even while medicated and sick, that John Ashcroft himself would draw a line made me feel that hope springs eternal, you know? So they pushed them so hard that I found newfound hope and optimism there. I'll have to think about a more substantive answer to the question, but it's an honest answer to the question.
You mentioned Attorney General Gonzalez, and he hasn't come up yet. Could you comment on the ongoing controversy about the U.S. attorneys, one of which was obviously here in San Francisco,
yeah,
and what stake, if any, the ACLU has in that?
Well, I think for us the concern is the politicization of the Justice Department, the insertion of partisan politics in a branch of government that needs to be more independent and more detached from the White House and the executive branch than it's been. And to be clear, the ACLU doesn't take a position one way or the other on the removal of Alberto Gonzalez. We never oppose or support individuals for appointed or elected office. But you need to look at his record. And you need to see that this man has been unwilling to ask the tough questions of his boss. In fact, he still considers George Bush his boss. And actually, his boss is the American people, where he's the country's highest-ranking law enforcement official who took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution for all Americans. And he's not engaged in independent investigations on the NSA wiretapping program. He rewrote the rules of torture and called the Geneva Conventions quaint and obsolete, and allowed that directive to fall like a boulder off a cliff down the military chain of command that gave us Abu Ghraib and gave us Guantanamo. He's someone who has not been willing to enforce, and in fact has dropped a number of important civil rights cases that were begun under the previous Justice Department. There's even one case that we, the ACLU, had to pick up because this Gonzalez Justice Department decided that this employment discrimination case on behalf of women janitors in New York was no longer an issue. So they dropped their clients, and then we had to step into the breach and continue to win and take that case and win it on their behalf. And so what you find is an erosion of the independence of the Justice Department. And even when you compare it to the Reno Clinton Justice Department, you find much less willingness to ask the tough questions. Jenna Reno was, with all of her difficulties with Waco and elsewhere, with Elian, whatever issues you take on those issues, she was willing to ask the tough questions of her boss, and she understood that she had a role as an attorney general, and this one has not, and has shown all of our greatest fears.
You mentioned erosion of independence and reluctance to ask tough questions. Would you comment on the role of the media in covering these issues in the last few years? You mentioned the New York Times being reluctant to publish certain information.
Yeah. I will say this to you. Some of the leading outlets are perhaps the ones I'm most critical of because I expect more from the Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. And you've seen greater coverage of these issues over the last several years, but it's been very slow in coming. I will tell you that in the aftermath of 9/11, I called a reporter every day for more than 4.5 weeks. Every day, I stalked this reporter. What are you writing about? Let's talk about the immigrants and the Muslims who are being deported. And it took us through January of that year to get the story covered on civil liberties. It shouldn't have been that hard. I was sitting in Guantanamo Bay in August of 2004, observing the first military commission proceedings, talking with other members of the press, and I was hearing statements from members of the leading press corps of these major outlets saying, Guantanamo doesn't look so bad, when all we were being shown is the Disney version of Guantanamo, and we weren't allowed into the cells or to meet the detainees themselves. So I think one lesson we now learn is now that the press is much more aggressive, that it needs to be aggressive from the get-go. It cannot wait for further indications that something is amiss. And I think it's ironic that it was the ACLU that wrenched out 100,000 pages government documents using the Freedom of Information Act talking about torture and abuse. It wasn't the Times, it wasn't the Post, it wasn't the Chronicle, it wasn't the LA Times, it wasn't the Wall Street Journal. It was the ACLU that got the government documents that, in fact, was able then to contest the fact that torture and abuse was happening on our watch. So we need to be more vigilant next time.
We have time for just one more question for Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the ACLU. Do Democrats have a chance to take the White House in 08? And if they do, what will they be able to do, and what do you think they would do to address the civil liberties concerns you've outlined today?
I don't know the answer to that question. I will say that one of the great things about my job is you look for bright lines. And when your job is defend the rights of all people all across America, there are very few bright lines. But one bright line we have is that we're not involved in partisan politics. And I can tell you, I'm concerned with what happens, but ultimately that is for another organization, another set of individuals to decide. What I will know is that whatever happens in November of 08 is not going to be a panacea, no matter who you elect. That any one of the candidates, every single one, you're going to have this accretion of law enforcement powers. You're likely to still have Guantanamo Bay still up and running. You're still likely to have challenges on judicial review and on the role of Congress. That happened under President Clinton. It's happening under President Bush. It will certainly happen under the next president. And that's why you need an organization that's vigilant and that's aggressive, that's a countervailing force, and that's nonpartisan in the defense of civil liberties, because you're going to need us no matter who you occupies the Oval Office. And that's what America is actually all about, is that the safeguarding of those basic rights, no matter who's in power, someone's got to do it. And with your help, we'll continue to do our very, very best. Thank you very much this evening.
Our thanks to Anthony Romero, Executive Director of the ACLU and author of In Defense of America. We thank our audience here on the radio. I'm Greg Dalton, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.